Are you a small business owner looking to scale your business and your profits? Are you looking for strategies to find balance in your life as an entrepreneur? Stay tuned while Craig Staley, founder of HG Site Design, a website design and marketing agency, shares strategies from successful small business owners, authors, and experts on how to do just that. Let's join Craig as he explores how we can all take our businesses to the next level on the Small Business School podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Small Business School podcast. Do you ever think about what might happen if you died tomorrow? What would happen to your business? Do you have a spouse that would take over, or maybe one of your kids? Do you have a partner? What would happen if you died tomorrow? It's really not something any of us want to think much about, but our guest today, Stephen Goodman, might argue that it's something we do need to think a little bit more about. We all need to do a little bit of succession planning to make sure that our business or the assets it has survives for our family after our death. So today's episode, we talk about a few things, about some obstacles that people encounter when they're doing succession planning. We also talk about some common mistakes that people should try to avoid when they're establishing their will and trust. All that and a lot more on today's episode with Stephen Goodman. All right. I'd like to welcome my next guest. It's Stephen Goodman. He is the president and CEO of SHG Planning. How are you today, Stephen?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. While we get started here, can you give the listeners a little bit of your personal background?
Sure. I started out in public accounting. I work for one of the big accounting firms, KPMG Peat Marwick. I'm a CPA. I also have my MBA in finance. I worked for a few years for JP Morgan in their private bank and trusted investment division. And for 30 plus years, I've owned a consulting firm, SHG Planning, where I do a lot of work in business succession planning, estate planning, risk management, insurance planning.
What was the impetus for starting your own consulting firm? How did that get started?
It's interesting. When I was with JP Morgan, which actually was Chemical Bank back then that merged into JP Morgan, I was in a division that was involved in asset management and estate planning and all those areas. And even though I wasn't dealing with the customers in those, I was doing more like internal reporting. I've always been an avid reader, and I got very interested in the subject and decided right before I was starting a family that I should try to go out and go into this field because I was very interested in it. And that's kind of how I got into the business.
That's great. Did you just kind of quit your day job and start it up, or was it kind of a side hustle at first and then you kind of grew it, or how did that work?
It was a real risky thing. I quit a reasonably good job.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, before I start a family, this is my last chance to take that kind of risk.
Sure.
And I did. And thankfully, it worked out.
That's awesome. Great story. So at what point would you say that business owners should start thinking about succession planning? And what might change to kind of alter those plans down the road?
Well, you know, look, everybody has a succession plan, whether you plan for it or not. Obviously, if you pass away or you get sick and you can't work anymore, well, there's got to be some succession. Is it the usual succession, unless it's a big business, is that the business is going to, in essence, close up and your family is going to get no value for the business if it's, you know, an early stage company where you don't really have partners or kids or family or key employees that can keep it going. So in those situations, usually people fit into one of two categories. They've done nothing and something happens to them because it's unexpected. They're young. You don't expect this to happen. And there's really no plan and there's no insurance and the family is in a very, very difficult situation. There are other people that say, well, I there really is no succession here. There's nobody for me to give it to. So I just have to make sure I have adequate insurance coverage, both life, disability, so that if something happens to me, I protect my family. Occasionally, there could be a key employee, but you know the employees don't have money to buy you out. If they buy you out, they're really buying you out with your own money. And if There's nobody there really overseeing the employee. What stops the employee from just kind of trying to steal all the customers and kind of do their own thing if you're not around to monitor what's going on? As you get more, as you get older and your business grows and gets bigger and bigger, different levels of complexity come into play when it comes to succession.
Interesting. So what are some of the biggest, and maybe you've named a few of them, but what are some of the biggest obstacles that you find when it comes to family businesses and obstacles maybe they encounter when they're trying to do succession planning?
Well, it's a good question. I've been asked it before, and that is, you know, why do people not have adequate planning? And I'm not necessarily referring to like a new startup. Let's take a more established business.
Sure.
Where there's kids in the business and dad and mom should be thinking about these things. Mm-hmm. There's usually two or three major reasons why it doesn't get done. The first is entrepreneurs' personalities are that they put out fires every day and they focus on what's the emergencies. There's probably something they knew when they got up in the morning was going to be an emergency, and then six other things took place during the day. So they're usually so preoccupied with putting out fires that anytime they take away from current issues to plan for the future, right off the bat, that's a difficult thing for most entrepreneurs, because there's always going to be something important to deal with today. And to take that time away to plan for the future, it's very hard for an entrepreneur to get that mindset. So that's one significant reason. A second big reason is a lot of the decisions are very difficult emotional decisions. I don't know about you, but I have two kids. I have a son and daughter. They're not involved in my business, but many, many times throughout the many years that they were, especially when they were home, they would play my wife and I against one another. And it would be like, well, you got John a bike. I want a bike. Or this one got a phone.
Sure.
I want a lollipop. And this one got a lollipop. And this one got a TV. And you tell your kids all the time, you shouldn't have to, but you do. I love you the same, and I'm always going to treat you the same. And the only reason your brother got the bicycle is because he's 9 and you're only 7. When you're 9, you'll get a bicycle. And of course, when they're 9, you'll get them a bicycle, because that's just how it is as parents. So you spend your whole life or your whole life with your children telling them how you love them the same and you're going to treat them the same. And then one day you wake up and you say, I got this really big business. I got three kids. Only one of them is involved in the business. The other two are not. They all could have come in, but two of them decided not to come in. And I don't have enough assets to divvy this up fairly, because the business is my major asset. So now what the hell am I going to do? Am I going to leave the business to all three of my kids? Well, that leads to a whole slew of problems, because you have two kids not involved in the business, and they could have a controlling interest in the business. That's a problem. I could leave it equally to my three kids, but give the voting rights to the child in the business. And that leads to multiple problems, because the child with voting rights could pull all the money out of the business and totally treat the other two siblings not the way the parents wanted them to be treated. And having a one-third interest in a closely held business without any voting rights really doesn't mean anything. You know, it's kind of worthless, because the one controlling the business could control the salaries and the distributions that everybody gets. So there's no easy way to solve that problem. I mean, my job is to give people all of the different choices and give them the pluses and minuses, but none of them are perfect. I'm not the messiah. I'm not going to come up with an idea that everyone's going to say, wow, that like solves every problem. You're never solving every problem, because every one of those kids, and especially their spouses, are going to think different things of problems than you could have thought of. So a lot of parents, especially dads, because in my generation, most of the businesses are still run by men. It's changing, but it's still men. Most dads are chicken. Like, they sit there and go, well, wait a minute. If I start doing planning and I tell my kids what I'm going to do, there's no doubt that somebody's not going to be happy about it. And I love my kids and I love my grandkids and I want to see my children. I want to see my grandkids. If I start bringing this up, I run the risk that I could hurt my relationship with one of my kids, their spouse, and maybe not see my grandkids. So I'm just going to be a chicken and I'm going to shut up and I'm not going to say anything, because I don't want that to happen. And when I'm dead, they'll have to deal with it. They'll kill each other. I'll have to deal with it, because I don't want to address these issues today. Mm-hmm.
But I won't be around to worry about it.
That's right. It's a combination of not having the discipline to plan for things in the future today, and realizing how difficult some of these decisions are going to be. And kind of like, if I die and everything's left equally to my kids, the worst thing anybody could say is, I can't believe my dad like never took the time. He's a smart guy. He never took the time to plan, but he kind of left it equally to everybody. So it's like, what's anybody going to say? I got three kids. I left everything equally. That's kind of almost like the standard way people leave things in their wills when after the second death of a husband and wife. My dad just didn't give it a thought. And the advisors could say, well, we tried to get your dad to plan, but he just never wanted to do it. But if I have like this sophisticated plan, like I really thought this thing out and I die, and my kids are going to sit there and go like, this was thought out. This wasn't just like dad just not thinking about this. Dad thought about this. And I can't believe that that's the conclusion that dad and mom came up with. And I'm pissed off. And now what's going to happen is they're going to take it out on their siblings because they're going to think they're not treated fairly. Because what I always say to people at the end of the day as a parent, I don't know if you're a parent, but if you're a parent, at the end of the day, when the scorecards are all up, it's not, oh, my kid went to Harvard or my kid went to Yale or my kid went to MIT, because they could have gone to those schools, but meanwhile, they could be a horrible human being and been married 6 times with 18 kids and not watched over their kids. And they're just not a good person. Who cares that they were smart? Okay. So at the end of the day, as a parent, what's your scorecard? Are my kids good people? Did I teach them well? Are they caring, loving parents and spouses? Do they get along with their brothers and sisters when I'm not here anymore? Are they going to get together for Christmas or Hanukkah or Thanksgiving? And like, did I do that good job? Like, to me, that's like the ultimate scorecard as a parent. If you did those things, forget what school your kid went to or how much money your kid made. That to me is the scorecard. Well, if you just leave a mess, the chances that that's going to lead to them all getting along is not going to be very high. So doing the planning while you're alive and telling your kids what you're doing gives you the best chance of that working out, because you're going to hear everybody's issues and you're going to be able to at least try to modify based on everybody's issues. And it's not going to be perfect, but at least you've gotten everybody's opinion rather than just leaving a disaster when you're not there anymore.
That's a great point about discussing the plan with people before you're gone. They can hear exactly what you're thinking, you know, rather from you than a lawyer or a planner or someone else that, you know, after the fact. So that's definitely good thought.
Plus, it gives you a chance to change things. If somehow you hear something from your kids and you say, you know something, there's some very good points that were raised here. You know, this is not just sour grapes. There's some very well thought out opinions here. And it gives me at least a chance to modify what I'm doing before I'm gone, rather than you're dead and, you know, there's nobody could change anything. And you're right, you're hearing it from a lawyer or a CPA instead of from mom and dad.
Direct from the source. Yeah. So how, you talked a little bit about life insurance. How does buying life insurance differ for someone who's a business owner versus someone who may have a 9-to-5 or work for somebody else?
Well, somebody who doesn't own a business, usually, unless they're very, very wealthy, mm-hmm. you know, where you get estate tax issues and stuff that come into play, like somebody who's like a hedge fund person or, you know, some big earner. So most employees, the major reason they buy life insurance is simply that if something happens to them and their income goes away, that the family could live something like the lifestyle that they lived before. Sure. Now, usually they'll have something. If it's a big company, they'll get some insurance from work, you know, but usually you need to supplement that. So, and generally term insurance, which is the least expensive insurance, that like renting insurance that covers you for 20 years or 30 years, generally that's going to be sufficient for most people who fit into those categories, because they don't really have the cash flow to buy a more permanent policy. And their needs really exist, you know, during those 20 to 30 years until their kids are old enough to be out of school and have a job and so on and so forth. So that's usually the reason if you're not a business owner. If you're a business owner, you could have you have the same issue, like, you know, what happens if something happens to me, then my kids and my wife and husband have enough money. But there's other issues. You could have partners, so you could have a buy-sell agreement. So you and I are 50-50 partners in a business, and we have an agreement that if one of us dies, we don't want to be partners with the other spouse. So you have insurance on me, and I have insurance on you, or the business has insurance. and we buy each other out. And that could be for life and for disability. Then it could be key man insurance. We could say, you know what? If you die and I collect insurance on you to buy you out, I've taken care of your wife and kids, but you are not there anymore. So like, I'm missing you. You and I are key people to this company. So I want to have a key man policy on you so that if something happens, money comes into the company to replace you and give me a chance to find somebody to do the things that you were doing. So it buys me some time. You could have key employees in a business that are not owners, but you want to lock them in so you buy insurance on them and provide them with like a combination retirement plan and a death benefit. So if they stick with the company or they die prematurely, their family gets assets. Then there is succession planning. Like I got two kids, one in the business, one not in the business. I'm going to leave the business to my child in the business, but I'm going to buy an insurance policy and trust in my other kid because I don't have enough other assets to give them. So I want to leave the insurance when I die to that child so that they're not, it's not treated equally, but at least in my mind and my heart, I feel like I took care of my other kid because I don't want one of my kids to live this great lifestyle when I die. Even though I built the business, so let's say it was mostly my doing, you know, and then my other kids living nowhere near the same lifestyle, and I don't want them to not get along. So I'll try to take care of both of them. So, and there's other reasons for insurance with a business, but a business has many, many, many more reasons somebody would need life insurance than just somebody who's just an employee in a company.
That's great. A lot of things I had never thought of before. That's interesting. What are some common mistakes that people should try to avoid when they're establishing their will or a trust?
That's a very good point. I would say to you, here's the big issues. Number one, the major reason why if I go and find a young couple with kids that do not have a will, almost always the single reason the wills have not been done is because they're fighting over who's going to be the guardian of the kids if something happens to both of them. I don't want your brother. I don't want your sister. I don't want your parents. I don't want your uncle. When in reality, unless they die in a common accident, like a car crash or a plane crash, whoever dies first, the other one could go and change their will. So if like you and I were married and I say, well, I don't want your sister as the guardian, but you want your sister and I die first, you'll just go to the lawyer after I die and you'll put your sister as the guardian. What am I going to do? I'm dead. You know what I'm saying? So usually that's the big issue. So some of the problems are holding up doing a will for guardians, even though the only time that's going to be a relevant point is if you die together. And, you know, what do you think the odds are of husbands and wives dying at the same time as one another? I don't know, what is it, 1 out of 1,000? I don't know what.
Yeah, who knows?
It's a small number. So we're going to hold up doing a will for that 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 chance that you're going to die together. It's like, get over it and just pick somebody and pull
a name out of a hat and there's the kids' guardians.
Just deal with it. So that's one issue. Second issue is asking somebody to be a guardian, but putting them in a very difficult financial position. So let's use an example. You're my brother. I'm picking you as my guardian. I'm wealthier than you. You have a nice house. Okay. You have two kids. You got 3-4 bedroom house. I got 3 kids. I die and I leave you as guardian. How the hell are you fitting my kids in your house? Where are you putting my 3 kids? I don't want my kids having like 4 kids in a room together. You've, in essence, taken on the single most important responsibility anybody could ever take on in my life, and that is to watch over my kids if something happens to me. I can't make your life a misery. So if that's the case, I have to have something in my will where I say, you know what? If something happens to me, I'm leaving you $250,000. It's yours. That's like your payment for being guardian, whether you do it through insurance, whether you do it through assets that you have. And the purpose of that $250,000 is for you to either expand your house or to buy a bigger house so that my children could fit in that house and doesn't make your life uncomfortable. I can't ask you to do that. Are you going to go spend $250,000 doing it when you're taking care of my kids? That's not right. You know what I'm saying? So people don't think that out. They don't think like, oh my God, what happens if you become my, where are you going to put my kids? You know? So that's an issue. Another big issue is whenever you pick somebody as a guardian, and I'll get into trustee in a second, but whenever you pick somebody as a guardian that isn't as wealthy as you are, you don't want animosity. So let's say I'm much wealthier than you. When I leave a trust and I pick you as the trustee and I say, you had to take, you know, $10,000 a year to send each of my two kids to camp, but you can't afford to spend $10,000 to send your kids to camp. How do you think it's going to look if your kids see my kids going to camp and they're not going to camp, when they're not going to as nice of a camp? You know what I'm saying? It's just no way that's not going to lead to a problem. So in essence, I have to say, you know what? I want you also to send your kids to camp. And I'm going to leave you enough that you send your, like, and you could always not do it. It's your choice. But I got to put you, because what's going to end up happening, because I've seen this. This happened to me personally. I've seen this. If I leave you in charge of everything, the kids and the money, and you have less than me, you're going to start rationalizing in your head. You know, I'm going to take some of the money from that trust and pay for my kids to go to camp. Steve would have wanted me to do that. I mean, he wouldn't have wanted me to have my kids not go to camp when his kids went to camp. But meanwhile, I never told you to do that. So you're kind of stealing money from my kids, but you're going to rationalize in your head that you're not stealing money because that's part of the responsibility I took. So the other thing that's sometimes important is sometimes you pick you as the guardian and you as a trustee, but then pick a second person as a trustee, somebody who's more financially astute. So this way, there's kind of like a little bit of checks and balances, but I don't want to insult you and not pick you as a trustee. So you're one of them, but there's also another one. And if you ask me, I'd say, well, I really picked this person because they're a CPA, they're a lawyer, they're professional at this. You're going to be taking care of my kids. You can't also be watching over all the money and the kids. It's just too much responsibility. You got a job. It's too much to ask you to do. So I'm kind of dividing up the responsibility. I'm really doing it to some degree because I want another pair of eyes, because I want to make sure somebody's really watching over the money. But at the same time, I'm going to instruct you and I'm going to instruct the trustee that there's certain things that I want you to have for you and your kids because of the fact that you're doing this for my children. You know what I'm saying? Now, I can see you shaking your head when I say this to you, because a lot of people don't think that way. You know, like, they do their will. Nobody's really said to them, holy smokes, like, you got to think this thing through a little bit, you know? And a lot of times they don't. And then a lot of bad things happen.
Yeah. You're not going to say, hey, here's my two kids. Here's money to send them to private school. Good luck with your kids. You know, it's got to be equal.
Yeah. Or you have to find somebody, which is hard. You have to find somebody as trustee and executor that's in the same financial situation you're in, so those issues wouldn't come into play. But a lot of times people pick, you know, who's the most logical person to pick as a guardian? It's going to either be your parents, it's going to be your brothers and sisters. I mean, that's generally who's going to be picked. And not all of them are in the same financial situation, because you could have like a sister that is far and away the one who you would trust the most to take care of the kids. She's a great mom, but her husband doesn't make a lot of money. He's nowhere in the same financial position that I'm in. And like, there's just no way that's not going to lead to some kind of problem.
Do you find it in the opposite sense, where you want to leave the kids to someone who's more well off than you, and then there becomes issues with maybe you're not leaving enough money for them to provide your kids the same life that they're providing their kids?
Look, that could be the issue.
Yeah.
But as long as I feel I'm leaving my kids the life that I think they should live, I'm okay with that. But I'm not going to say that that isn't an issue. But then you may not be able to do it. You could be leaving it to someone that's so much wealthier than you. You can never compete with them, and you're never going to have your kids live the same lifestyle. Now, sometimes what will end up happening is if you have somebody that's like a brother or a sister, and they're like super, super wealthy, they're going to probably just take care of your kids and just
the same way. Yeah.
All the same things with your kids. They're probably not even going to take the money from their trust fund to do it, because they're going to say, I got so much money. What am I not going to take care of my brother or sister kids? Well, I'm going to take their money to do it. I could afford to do it. It doesn't have any bearing on me. You know, I mean, I'm not going to take care of every expense for the rest of their life, but certainly during the years where they're a kid and it's so easy to compare one to another, I'm not going to not take care of them, you know? So
yeah, it probably doesn't happen as much the other way.
More the other way where you, but your question was a fair point. It could be an issue.
Yeah. Okay. What are some estate planning techniques that, you know, high net worth individuals utilize to maximize their wealth preservation after they're gone?
Well, first off, you know, big question mark today is we don't know what's going to go on here, because clearly Biden, if he can get what he wants done, which is not going to be easy because the Democrats have, you know, very, very slim, you know, majorities in the House and the Senate. So he's got to get pretty much everybody to agree, because anything that says taxes go up, it seems like 100% of the Republicans are going to say no to. Not one's going to agree to it. So he's got to get every Democrat to say yes. So I don't know what's going to happen, but under today's law, and we don't have enough time for this, and some of this is complicated, but generally the things that wealthy people are doing is you have a lifetime, federal lifetime exemption for gift and estate of, like, you know, between a husband and wife, it's like $23 million. So you could make a lot of gifts while you're alive and try to move assets out of your estate, especially assets that you think, like, you know, you're going to buy this building and you're going to buy it, like, almost fully mortgage it. But you think this, like, $10 million building that you're going to have like a $9 million mortgage on is going to be worth $40 million, you know, 5 years from now, because something's going to happen in the neighborhood and you want to move that asset out of your estate. So you gift it. It's only a gift of $1 million because that's the equity in it. But that million of equity could be 20 million of equity 5 years from now. And now it's no longer in your estate. It's in trust for your kids. So when you die, that asset isn't part of your estate. So a combination of, like, selling assets and gifting assets, especially assets that you can discount, because it's not like, it's not like IBM stock where you go in the paper and you say it's worth X amount per share. It's like a minority interest in a LLC that owns a building. Well, first off, what's the building worth? Well, who knows what the building's worth? There's no clear-cut value to the building. Now it's in an LLC and I'm giving away a minority interest in it. Well, if even if I got a building worth $10 million with no mortgage and you're my son and I give you a 33% interest in an LLC that owns that building, so theoretically, you own a third of a $10 million asset, but who's going to buy that asset from you? Go try to find somebody to buy your one third interest in a building when the other two thirds are owned by somebody else and they can control everything. So if you could ever sell it, you're going to get a lot less than $3.3 million for it. So maybe you could value it at $2 million and give it away. And maybe in the future, it'll be worth $15 million. So it's things like that, closely held businesses, real estate, LLCs. Those are the types of things that the wealthy people, you know, are doing. And then on top of it, a lot of wealthy people buy life insurance because it provides liquidity when they're gone to pay the estate taxes, because many times the assets that are in the estate are illiquid and the government wants their money. So the insurance ends up providing the liquidity to pay the taxes.
Interesting. So let's transition a little bit from the finance side to more business side. But what would you say has been the biggest challenge that you faced in your 30 years of being a business consultant? How did you overcome it?
Well, some things you almost never totally overcome, but
yeah.
You know, I think some of the biggest issues is the frustration of people's lack of being open-minded and the difficulty in moving people to take action. So it's like, I meet people that they're just not open-minded. You know, it's like they have an accountant, they have an attorney, and they figure like everything's done. And it's like, I feel like saying to the person, you know, you're an electrical contractor. Like, don't take this the wrong way, but you don't have a clue as to whether it's done right or not. That's not what you do for a living. What you could tell me is that you trust your advisors. And I would think your advisors would have no reason not to do what's in your best interest. But it doesn't mean there aren't ideas that your advisors have not told you that could help you. So being closed-minded to listen to people and get new ideas, probably my most frustrating thing I deal with. And then the second thing is when I finally do get in front of somebody, having the challenge of moving them to take action for the reasons we talked about before is the other thing that could become very, very frustrating. And I overcome it sometimes, but not always.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see someone in your mind maybe driving off a cliff with a decision they are or aren't making. And, you know, it's frustrating probably to not kind of get them convinced the right decision for them.
Yep.
On the opposite side, what would you say has been the best moment in your business's history so far?
Well, you know, just knowing that I've helped a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of people that I've moved to do planning and to take action, that if something would have happened to them, their family is going to be in a much better place than they would have been in. That doesn't mean if they didn't meet me, they may not have done it with somebody else. But, you know, I'd like to give myself a little bit of a pat on the back to feel like I've had my skills, both my knowledge and my ability to deal with people has allowed me to accomplish things that not everybody would have been able to accomplish. So I think that's what's given me a lot of, a good feeling.
Who do you consider a mentor, and what would you say is the most important lesson they taught you?
You know, unfortunately, my parents passed away very, very early in life. So I say my mom had some influence over me, but, you know, not in my, in my business life. I don't know if I've had specifically a mentor in business. You know, I've had partners over the years, and I feel that although there's a lot of challenges in being in a partnership, you know, I feel that, you know, being with other smart people, you know, you learn a lot if you're open-minded to listen, you know, you learn from them. So I think that I've learned things from having partners over time. And I'm somebody who always wants to learn. Like I read constantly, and I don't read like, you know, novels. You know, almost everything I read is learning about something, whether it's in my business, whether it's healthcare, finance, education. So I've mentored myself a lot by just constantly trying to better myself and know something today that I didn't know yesterday.
That's great. So before we get to the last question, where can our listeners find out more about you and your business?
Well, a couple of things. I wrote a book on business succession planning. And if they go to stephengoodman.biz, they could download a free copy of it. Also, if you go to shgplanning.com is my website. I have probably 70 articles that I've written on various different subjects there, as well as, you know, I have some of the podcasts and videos that I've done on a lot of these subjects there. My email address is sgoodman@shgplanning.com. And best number to reach me is always my cell, 516-297-7390.
That's great. I'm going to have to check out that book, and we will provide links to all those resources on the show notes here. So last question, if you could hop into a time machine and go back to the year that you launched your business, what piece of advice would you give your past self?
That's very good. I would say to you that I made a decision a long time ago, and it's clearly there's a positive and a negative to it, to not be a jack of all trades and a master of none. So like my focus has been almost exclusively in estate planning, business continuity planning, insurance planning. But there's a lot of other businesses. If I could do it all over again, I probably would have partnered up with people that specialized in ancillary things to what I do. As an example, somebody who specializes in health insurance, somebody who specializes in property and casualty insurance, you know, like homeowners, car, business insurance, somebody that manages money, so that I would have had more of a multifaceted business where, you know, once I got you as a client, I could offer you all of these things. Instead, I kind of took the position that I would be great at this narrow thing, and I would refer you to people in those other disciplines, and they would refer their clients to me rather than encompassing it. But maybe in hindsight, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't have done all those things myself, because it's impossible to do all of those things. But I probably would have partnered up with people in these other disciplines and had a little bit more of a broad offering to clients.
Definitely an interesting perspective, because you hear cases for both where people say, hey, you need to have a niche and then you'll be the expert, you know, and I think that's probably true. But I'm sure you've had customers in the past that say, hey, can you help me with this? And then in that case, you're referring them off to someone else.
Yeah, the biggest obstacle even more than that is just there are times I meet somebody that could use help in areas outside of what I do. And it's hard if you don't get them as a client first to bring them to other areas. You know, if you're my client and then I want to bring you to other things, it's easier than to just bring you to other things when I'm not a client. And of course, what I offered wasn't as, you know, widespread, multidisciplinary. Sometimes there would be people I just lost that opportunity to have them be a client because they didn't really need what I principally had to offer.
Well, Stephen, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the show. This is a topic we haven't covered. And I think to your earlier point, sometimes a topic that's avoided or not the first thing that as entrepreneurs we think about. So I really appreciate your time and all the value you brought today.
I appreciate it as well. You asked me a lot of good questions, and hopefully everybody in the audience got at least one thing out of this conversation that will be a benefit to them.
I'm sure they did. I know I've got more research to do after this conversation. So thanks again.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Small Business School podcast. If you like what you heard, please share it and leave a review. It would mean the world to us. If you are a small business owner or looking to start a business, join the Small Business School Facebook group. It's a private community of people focused on helping each other take their businesses to the next level. To learn more about our guest today or to be a feature guest on the Small Business School, go to craigsdaily.com/podcast for more info.